I'm Pastor Kenneth Glasgow. I am the national president of TOPS, the Ordinary People Society. And we're back, we're on our way. We have two vans. We took to Detroit for the United States Social Forum. I do a lot of reform work on prisoners, on feeding people. We have feed in Dothan, Alabama, about 180 homeless people a day. We got a big, strong youth program, and those are the ones we took up on the van, about 16 youth. We were on our way back, and we heard about a youth in Atlanta getting murdered in teen violence or youth violence. One of the things that we're strong in, also in the Ordinary People Society Prodigal Child Project, is ex-felon voters' rights. And you probably heard of us. We're the ones that got the ex-felon voting rights lawsuit in Alabama, and got the lawsuit won to where they could vote out of prison, making Alabama the first state in the nation that they could vote in and out of prison depending on what crime they have. Maine and Vermont, they could always vote out of. This is the first state that it took litigation, and it was total advocacy and organizing that did it. So while we're on our way back from United States Social Forum, all fired up, all, you know, the youth are ready, coming up with great ideas and all, we come and stop to visit our local branch here in Atlanta. Our state president here, Tanya Colbriff, was getting ready to do a vigil for Terry Moody, who's 18 years old. He's a local performer with Polo Kids. And he was at a block party performing last night, and a fight broke out. Five people ended up getting shot, and one fatality, which was Terry Moody. And you got two that's still in critical. Terry Moody was a young man that was interviewed for T.I.'s reform thing that he was doing. And he was a high school graduate. He just graduated at Mays High School. Very good in his academics and all. Beautiful young man. And we just wanted to stop here. We're going to do a vigil. It's going to be at William Mills Park right there off of Martin Luther King. And we're going to tell him enough is enough. We're tired of all the senseless and useless killings of each other. You know, it's bad enough that we're fighting against all of our young black men, more so than any others, going to jails and prisons, you know, by statistics and also per capita. But then we also got to deal with the fact of them killing each other as well.
How big of a problem is youth violence in this community?
Oh man, youth violence in this community seems to be on the uprise. Chicago is number one. Baltimore, Maryland, believe it or not, is up there in the running. New York, New Jersey, and then Atlanta. And so in California, of course. Okay? So what we're doing is we've been going around trying to share with the youth as being ex-felons, as being ex-gang members and ex-gang leaders. And you really don't know who you're talking to. I'm Al Sharpton's biological brother, who he talks about, that went to prison for 14 years and got out and started this ministry called TOPS, the Ordinary People Society. Been out over 10 years, and we have a big, strong monitoring and mentoring program in our Prodigal Child Project that talks to them and tell them, hey, we used to be the predators, but now we're acting as your protectors. You know, and if you're trying to envy us, aggrandizing us, we're the ones that should be out there and telling you that that's not the way to be, because we used to be the ones carry the guns and carry the, and do commit the violence.
Okay, you gave me a whole bunch to unpack there. Did you just say you're Al Sharpton's biological brother?
Yes, I am.
Who would know? And the
out
other
of all places, huh?
Out of all places, right?
Yes.
The other thing, you talked about yourself being a gang member, carrying a gun, going to prison. You yourself have gone to prison?
14 years.
Tell me, would you be comfortable telling me about that?
No problem. Everybody knows it's my testimony. Well, I was out there selling drugs and using drugs. I got on crack cocaine. After a long period of time, maybe 15 years, I got to a point I was tired of it, and I was just kept catching charges, selling drugs, using drugs and drug possession. And then, you know, I start robbing people, and I got two armed robberies. I got two attempt of armed robberies, also along with those 14 drug charges and the battery charge, which landed me with facing a life sentence. And I ran from Alabama, ran to Florida, caught more charges, ended up doing 2 years, then 2 years, and then 9 years, 8 months, and 17 days, which adds up with all my jail time, over 14 years in prison and jails. Didn't get a chance to see my children or raise my children. Even my child that you see there now Kendre. He's 17 years old now.
I'll talk to Kendre after you.
Yeah, and he basically was growed up without me even being there because I was in prison. So I wanted to make sure I come back and try to save my own children, but I also had to look at, I was one of the ones that committed it and caused a lot of the uproar and messed up. So I wanted to clean up where I had messed up. So I got out and got the vision in 1994. I didn't get out of prison until 2001. Wrote letters to my brother Al Sharpton about how I wanted to change my life and all. I guess he took it like, oh, that's just that jailhouse religion is not true. But thank God, here 10 years later, we got a strong organization that is known. We got about 20 branches in Alabama, about 20 branches across the nation. And it's steady growing, strictly volunteers. And what we do, feed people. A youth program, bridging the gap with the elderly, and we focus on restoration. Somebody say restore.
Okay, so I talk to people all the time who've been in prison and have gone back, and they don't straighten out their life in a long-term kind of way the way you have. What is it that did it for you?
Well, what did it for me is I really got mad. I got out and wanted to get my rights back and be classified as a citizen. I didn't want to bring shame to my family. We changed my name from Kenneth Sharpton to Kenneth Glasgow, so it wouldn't reflect shame on my family. And now I see, you know, it's even better because now I got my own identity in what I'm doing. My brother do what he do. But I got out and I wanted to get my rights back. I wanted to get a job. I wanted to get a house and had a lot of people lived in the projects and wanted to further my education and all that, and couldn't. I found out I couldn't because I was what? Disenfranchised. A lot of people don't know when a person loses their voting rights, it's not just about voting. You can't get a student loan, a Pell Grant. You can't get a public housing. Can't get public assistance or food stamps if you got a drug charge, you know. And then you can't get a business license. So a person that has drug charges really is set up in a position to where he have to recidivate because there's no jobs going to hire you once you tell them that you're check the box that you're an ex-felon. So we're doing the Ban the Box campaign. We got the ex-felon voters' rights. We got the rights and restoration. And what we're up here doing now is the unity in the family. So I try to keep my family with me as much as I can so we can restore our family ties and our bonds, you know, because there's still some issues that Kendre got that he got to deal with. I wasn't there for him. And so that's what really pressured me to keep going. I got mad they wouldn't give me my rights. I couldn't, you know, live life as a citizen. So I got mad. I said, I'm not a second-class citizen. I'm a second-chance citizen. God gave me a second chance, and society should do the same.
So you think that when people are labeled as a felon, that actually keeps them off of the right or the safe or the legal path? Right.
Oh, most definitely. It puts them in a position where the collateral consequences causing you to have to survive, live life on life terms. So I, for one, don't understand why we would make policies and laws that would keep a person disenfranchised. If we really want to spend all that money that we spend on the prison industrial complex, it only takes 1/3 of the cost to spend it on getting somebody treatment who has a drug addiction. And then you're committing what? Harm reduction. The reason we feed people is because I know when I was out there using crack, if you feed me, it dissipates my high. I come down, I won't rob, I won't steal, and I won't go in your house, okay? And if you help me get some clothes, then I ain't got to go try to rob and steal to get none. If you help me start getting the education, then I'll learn how to become a productive citizen. And if you're really a productive citizen, then I don't think a nice car, a nice house, or a nice job makes you a productive citizen. It says in the Bible, every seed produces of its own kind. So if you're really a productive citizen, produce some productive citizens.
Okay, two questions, and I also want to talk to your son. Can I talk to you too? It won't be bad.
Sure.
Okay, so I'm working on something called the rhythm of change, and you are somebody who has embodied change.
Come on now.
Tell me, what does that mean to you, and how does it apply to your life?
The rhythm of change. When I first got out, I thought that all of the churches was going to receive me, they was going to help me, they was going to be in behind me, they was going to support me, and I was going to go start feeding people and start this empowerment center and help people get their lives together, and everybody was going to love it. And when I got out, I found out that the system was not created that way. That while we was fighting classism of being black and white, their whole agenda was, while we was fighting racism of being black and white, their whole agenda was classism. And when I found that out, I realized that my fight wasn't my fight. My enemy wasn't who I thought my enemy was. My fight was to go out with the ordinary people in society, like all of the prophets before us, Jesus, Muhammad, Buddha, whoever else. And what they did is they started to get all of the people together and the masses of people. There's only two kind of powers in existence: money power and people power. And the people power is what made ultimate change. So in the rhythm of change, we have to change the mindset of the people. If we change the mindset of the people and the powers that be and the so-called leaders, no matter who they are, then we'll start to change policy and laws that fit the people.
So you know what? I lied. I have two more questions for you. So somebody who's in a struggling situation who maybe finds family within a gang and makes some poor choices, or they're contemplating joining a gang. What kind of advice would you have to that person?
The main advice I would have to them is to first of all, come sit down and talk to us. And the reason why is because we'll talk the language and lingo that they know.
And how can they talk to you?
Oh, they could call me at 334-791-2433. Or they could go on the website, weartops.org, weareTOPS.org. And when they do that, they'll find somebody that done been there, done that. We are participating in what is called Not Enough is Enough and stopping the violence, because we were the predators that are now the protectors, and we want everybody to look at it. If you really a gangster out there, if you really a thug, then it don't mean hurting your brother, your sister. Being a real gangster, the thug, or something like that, is when you can stand up and take this mess that they putting you through, handle it, and still come through and be a better person regardless.
So then the person who's not ready to call you yet, if they're just going to consider one thing, or if you have to plant one seed of advice for them, what would that be?
The one seed of advice that I would plant for them is this: you're not a second-class citizen. You're a second-chance citizen. Once you start treating yourself like that, everybody else must do the same.
And finally, what is the most important lesson you've learned on your life journey, and how did you learn it? Just that.
The most important thing I learned on my life journey is to not be selfish and to see the forest and stop looking at the trees. And what I mean by that is, in order for us to be an arc bender, in order for us to be a life changer, in order for us to be in the beat of the rhythm of change, in order for us to be a change agent, we have to realize that we're not soldiers. Soldiers could go on AWOL, they could become mercenaries, they could get paid off, or become sellouts, but we have to be warriors. A warrior is his instinct, it's instilled in him, not only to be comfortable and fight in the war zone, but to protect everyone else around him.
Awesome, anything you wanna add?
Only thing I would add is that if anybody out there is listening, just remember that we're just ordinary people helping ordinary people, doing extraordinary things by the power and the Spirit of God. No will of our own. All glory belongs to Him. And what we want for ourselves, we want for everyone else.
And now I'm going to steal you. Can I?
Sure.
Okay, tell me what your name is.
My name is Michael Thomas.
And so I just heard a little bit about you from your dad. How old are you?
I'm 17 years old.
Okay, what have you learned from your dad?
Actually, I learned a lot. The value of life is one. If you sit up on a high pedestal, and one thing I learned that all good things must come to an end. And if you have that high pedestal attitude, drop it and bring it down, because God, He will set you on His own pedestal and bring you down from something to nothing.
So your dad talked about having some regrets about not being there for you as you were growing up. What was that like for you to grow up without your dad in the same household much of the time?
Sometimes it was okay. No pain. My mother and I have godparents that I dearly love, and they kind of took me under their wing and stuff like that, and helped me along the way. So that's what really got me through and things like that. Learning from them and things like that. Then after my dad got out, reconnecting with him and different things like that. Now I'm helping him as his executive assistant, doing things with his ministry and feeding the hungry and homeless and things like that. So it has really been a joyous time with him and things like that.
What do you think that people might misunderstand about people who've been a felon, or they're like convicted felons, or people who've been through the prison system? What are some things that people misunderstand about that population?
The most thing that people misunderstand about that is they think when other people get out of prison or jail or something like that, and they see them and they know them and things like that, they have this, oh well, they shouldn't have did that because that's the reason why they was there in the first place, or they shouldn't have done what they did, or shouldn't have talked to the judge or something like that what they did, and that's what makes people in the prison system look at when they get out, and it looks like to them that, you know, they when they get out that people don't understand them and don't care for them anymore.
Got it. And for you, what's your dream? Your dad's taken quite a toll turn with his own life. What do you want to happen for you in the future?
Well, I am I'm going to college pretty soon, pursuing my degree in funeral directing. Kind of like doing that and having a couple of funeral homes open. But one passion I have is for Alzheimer's. I have a great aunt. She is deceased now from Alzheimer's, and I helped her along the way since I was a little bitty boy, and she passed this year right before I turned 17, and I plan to open up different Alzheimer's home to help for Alzheimer patients and things like that, because if you don't know how to deal with them, you just can't bring them home and say, okay, well, I'm going to keep them, but you don't really know how to deal with them. And with trained professionals and things like that, I think that would be a very good deal.
I have never met anyone who's been, and I've never met an aspiring funeral director before. What is it that inspired you to want to do that?
Well, like I said, in January of 2010, I had an uncle that passed, and I helped take care of him. And then after that, after my great aunt passed in April, I was like, well, let me try something new, and I always like to try new things, and I'm good with science and things like that. And so once I began I started working at this funeral home, and I began liking it, and so I decided, well, this is something that I would want to do in life and make good benefit, because everybody have their own dream in life, and you know, it takes certain people to do things like this, and so that's what I believe.
So you lost people who are special to you, and you want other people to have a special experience when they lose somebody.
Correct, because the way it is, if you want someone when you lost someone, you want them to love on them, even though they're deceased, but you still want them to love on them and give them the proper care that you want them to have.
What have you learned, on another note, what's the most important lesson that you've learned along the way, and who did you learn it from?
The most important thing that I learned is a quote called, "It's All About Choices," and I learned it from my godfather. He is a very, very spiritual man, and the one that helped me along the way. And he used to tell me that. He used to put me in my lap as we was driving, and he go, you know, it's all about choices. And I go, and I call him Papa. I go, Papa, what do you mean by that? And he go, well, you know, you make good choices, you end up with good things. But you make bad choices, you can correct those bad choices with good things. So I think that's one thing that I'll help learn me and get me along the way.
And a lot of people, sometimes people say, well, if someone's parents are in prison, they're definitely going to follow their path. So obviously you've proven that's not true. What is it that kept you so strong?
Well, hanging out with my godparents and my mother, she's a very strong woman, and my stepfather and things like that. And especially my great aunt. My great aunt, we used to just, she used to babysit me when I was little and things like that, and used to go over to her house after school. And so that's what really kept me together and things. So, and that's most of my stuff that I learned from her, and most of my wisdom I learned from her and stuff like that.
Okay, we're getting close to the end. And the most important thing you learned from your dad?
The most important thing that I learned from my dad, even though that you have did something wrong in life, you have a chance to relive it again.
And finally, the last question is the rhythm of change. What does that mean to you? How does it apply to your life?
The rhythm of change, it applies to my life in a very special way. I think that if we, everybody needs a rhythm of change in their life, and get outside the box. Because if so many people are stuck in their own comfort zone, and you know, sometimes when you get stuck there, and sometimes you just comfort where you at. And so the rhythm of change, I think it will help people get outside their normal box and start mingling and start going to different things and things like that. So